But first, the Richard smartphone that we check constantly, our emails, our Facebook account if we have one, the Google Maps, etc. And there's always this niggling sense that we are giving up a little more of our privacy every bloody day. Now, my next guest shares that concern and says we shouldn't be so comfortable trading our privacy for convenience. He says retailers aren't just using our smartphones to create detailed profiles of us and to track us online. They're starting to track us as we move around in the real world. Joseph Turo is a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communications, and I asked him to talk us through the process. We're shopping together. We have an app on our phone for a department store, a supermarket, for example, or a favourite clothing chain. What sort of information does that mean the store can glean from us?
Well, of course, depending on where it is, depending on when it is, and we're talking now about the beginning of an era, so not all stores do this, but potentially that store could have known that you were approaching the store by geolocation. That is, if your phone is on and you can get messages into your text message box, for example, the store will tell you that you should come to them as opposed to another store and maybe give you a discount for walking in. You walk in the U.S., there's a company called Shopkick. Maybe that exists in Australia in some stores. That store, that company knows you've walked in by an inaudible sound that hits your phone and tells that because you have their app and tells the company you're there. If you go to various places in the store and you scan particular products, you get points from Shopkick. That store may also have its own apps and connect it to something called Bluetooth Low Energy, which is a kind of frequency connected to a device that's on the wall that will know where you are around the store as you walk through it. So literally, prices and messages could change for you depending on where you are.
Does it follow you into the unisex toilet?
Not yet. No, I don't think so. But beyond that, it could know, for example, that you're in front of the diaper area, and it might know that you have bought certain brands of diapers or that you just had a child. And as a consequence, it might offer you a certain amount off based upon how they score you. If you're an important customer, you might get more compared to the person standing next to you. That is a greater discount. It's all in the phone. It's not on the shelf. And the phone has become a marketing device. So as you walk around the store, you get all these messages and all these support systems. When you walk out of the store, potentially the store knows how long you were standing in front of, for example, a lawnmower. It can then assume that you were interested in but not that interested in it to buy, and you may start getting messages as you walk through the world and even in your home computer for that lawnmower.
You know, I'm suddenly feeling a strong compulsion to stand in front of a lawnmower in which I have absolutely no interest, if only to confuse the...
Just to confuse. There are people who talk about that, to confuse the marketers. They call it obfuscation. The idea is to do crazy things, to exchange frequent shopper cards. I'm not sure it's all that helpful. But the point is that people feel one way they can fight back is through confusion. It's true.
If I was looking at lawnmowers in Australia, I would have a predisposition to buy a brand called Victor, a rather heroic Australian brand. In fact, their lawnmowers en masse featured in the opening ceremony at the Sydney Olympics. Does this system identify brand loyalty?
Oh, for sure. In a number of ways. It can see what you've searched for, depending, again, on the retailer, depending on how this has worked. But I'm talking potential, right, in terms of what are the technological capabilities today. Companies track what you do online. They can compare what you do online to what you're doing in the store. Stores communicate with one another, that is, with their online and their offline. They can buy data about you from data companies that will say what you've done in other places offline. And they certainly can know the products you've had, the products you might be looking at online, and as a result, know the brands that you've looked to.
I suspect that when a little thing comes up on my screen saying, can we track your location, this is to do with geolocation marketing?
Exactly. Now, a lot of times what happens is your listeners may realize that they'll say, why am I seeing this? This app has nothing to do with location. And often they'll say, okay, because they're in a rush, they want the app. What's going on exactly right there is that the app is selling your presence. They're basically saying to a marketing exchange, we will let you have this person for some recompense, and you can then send messages to this person as he or she walks around the world.
I learned from you that Uber changed its privacy policy so that they can track customer movements even when they're not using the app. Apparently, yes. The app is sending data to Uber about where you are, even when you're not on.
And you have to say that you don't want it that way. They've gotten into some trouble about that. A lot of companies do this. Most people don't realize that apps can be on. They sleep. And so a marketer can make an app go on as you walk into a store, even if you don't realize it's on. There are ways to shut it off. One way, for example, in an iPhone is to flick it up, and that shuts off that app. But you really have to have an app off if you don't want it to wake up.
And Joe, you always say no to any such request about location.
Yes, I do. Although if you're going to use a mapping, you have to. I mean, Google Maps, for example. But I would only do it when I'm needing the map, not all the time. It's very hard to go off the grid. I mean, the way to totally disappear is to not have Wi-Fi on, not have Bluetooth on, never use a frequent shopper card, and not use your credit card. That's very, very difficult. And I have heard anecdotal evidence, not only that. In fact, I was in Toronto yesterday, and a person raised his hand.
I knew you were in Toronto yesterday because we've been tracking you.
Yes, okay, well, it's possible. But anyway, so this guy, the student with a long beard, looked like a mountain man, raised his hand and said, I have been trying to go off the grid, and I've really not used any of these devices, not used any cards. And one time I tried to apply for a loan, and I had a lot of trouble because they were very suspicious of me. They had no record of me. So you get punished sometimes by being off the grid. It's bizarre.
We offer regular listeners, frequent listener points. It's an innovation that we're trialing here at the ABC. Yes, we're the first people to actually do it. Yeah. So everyone listening to you today is getting frequent listener points. Are these sort of reward programs a good thing or a two-edged sword?
A double-edged sword, of course. They started out just being essentially one way and being literally for loyalty with some interesting problems. I don't know if you remember green stamps. Green stamps were this, they may have been a different color in Australia, but the idea was when you went to a store and you bought, say, $10 worth of stuff, you would get these stickers that you put in a book. And if you filled up the book, you would then go to a redemption center and you could get various goods as a result of it. One company in the U.S. was even giving fur coats away if you collected enough books. That was okay to an extent. It encouraged people to buy stuff, but there was no exclusivity, and the stores didn't really know that it was they that you really cared about, because you could go to a number of different stores. Now what's going on is that frequent shopper cards and a lot of other things, including these phone relationships we've just talked about, literally are one thing they try to do is to get you to be loyal by giving you points and other kinds of inducements. But the real purpose of loyalty programs, they call them rewards programs, is data. The purpose is to collect data about us. The frequent shopper card is an amazing ability to collect just about everything that you purchase. And companies are more and more trying to use that to figure out what your profile should be and how to score you, whether you're important to them, more important, less important. As I say, this is just emerging. It's only a few years old, really, to the extent of doing anything with it seriously. And as time goes on, we'll see much more.
I remember the first loyalty program Well, the first I can recall in this country, and it wasn't green stamps, it was Lanshu tea, which was a very popular tea. This is in the era before coffee started to erode tea's market share.
What year are we talking?
We're talking the 40s and into the future. And every kitchen drawer in Australia was overflowing with Lanshu coupons, which were basically just one end of the packet. And you could redeem these to get tea towels and stuff like that. Pretty harmless. Now, what do they actually... No, let me rephrase that. Some people, I understand, are labelled as targets and others as waste.
Yes, I wrote about that in a previous book. The waste is simply the notion that you're not terribly important to an advertiser. Online or in a store, but particularly online. Companies really don't want to waste money on people who are not going to buy stuff from them or who they don't think are going to bring them margins, good margins of profit. And so when you talk about targets, these are people who, if you pay to reach them, in the case of advertising, they're useful. If they're not useful, they're waste. If you reach them and you paid for them and they're not useful, they're kind of wasteful to you. That's the perspective.
So, on the one hand, you could be socially liberal, organic eater, a diabetic individual, or a single city struggler.
Yes, right. And there are companies. Nielsen, the American company, owns a company called Claritas Prism, which will look at regions in the U.S., their zip codes, and they will describe the regions in ways that you've just mentioned. So, for example, one place is called Shotguns and Pickups, and another is called Blue Blood Estates. And the notion is to describe for marketers the kinds of people, the kinds of income that they have in those areas to help them decide whether or not to put businesses there. But more and more, we're moving away from that. The purpose of this book is to point out partly that we're moving away from segments to personalization. It's less the neighborhood than what I know about you. There's a company called Cambridge Analytica in England that actually helps companies collect enormous numbers of data points. And then what they do is they profile these people psychologically. And they argue that they helped Trump win, supposedly, by bringing together enormous amounts of data about people and then sending them very different messages depending on the psychological profiles of those people. And supposedly thousands of different messages based upon the various sort of descriptions of the individuals that they were giving. And that's kind of the future. The future is right now marketers are never really using that many data points. But the future is how are we going to look at you individually, your background, your proclivities, the kinds of stuff you buy, and how are we going to predict what you're going to do next?
Well,
and
if that's the future, I'd now like to lurch into the past because you go back in the history of buying and selling to the era of the peddlers and suggest that this profiling harks back to then and them.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I only learned this as I was going into the history of retailing. I sort of put things together. But if you look at the history of retailing, of selling, before they had supermarkets, before they had department stores, they had peddlers and small merchants. And these guys would go around. I'm sure this was true in Australia. It was true in Europe, true in the U.S. And they would often mark things at the bottom of the piece of goods they were selling, codes. They knew how much they paid for it. And they would charge people different prices, show people different things based upon what they thought they knew about those people and based upon the network they thought these people belonged to. What I'm arguing, and then what happened, the rise of department stores moved away from this. A lot of the department stores began in the 1850s or so to start charging posted prices. Part of the reason was they were afraid that the clerks wouldn't learn how to bargain properly. So they figured they would go into this posted pricing mode. And they began to have this idea of a democratic approach to shopping, that everybody would see everything, everybody would be charged the same kind of stuff. That's the history of the 20th century. What I'm arguing in this book is that because of the rise of first the scanner in the store and then the internet and then stores having to compete with the internet, we're moving into an era that's sort of back to the future. Just as in the peddler era, because of profiles we don't even understand that are statistically driven, we're going to get messages and prices that are supposedly for us. And you may not even know what your next door neighbor pays for the same exact thing.
A sudden thought enters my neurons and synapses. Does this technology have any significance, or will it inhibit the activities of shoplifters?
It's a very interesting question. Shoplifting, one way that they try to inhibit shoplifters is by using facial recognition in some places. So there are ways now to put former shoplifters into a database. And when a shoplifter, I've read, walks into a store, the camera will notify the security guards, and they'll actually escort the person out of the store. Which you say, well, you know, the person was a shoplifter, but that may have happened 10 years ago. So I don't know if that's such a very nice thing to do. But at any rate, that's one way in which shoplifting, the notion is that shoplifting can be derailed by high technology.
I was thinking of the situation where perhaps a potential shoplifter is standing in front of a motor mower and thinking, how can I shove this up my jumper? Len Unnell on RN Summer. And we're talking about the brave new world of shopping, where retailers are getting to know more about you than you'd like them to know, with Joe Turo, author of The Aisles Have Eyes. Okay, Joe, the privacy paradox.
Yes. That is the idea that most of your listeners would say, I care about privacy or privacy, but they will give up their data when they go into stores, when they want discounts. And so marketers will say, you know, you think that's a paradox. What's really going on, marketers say, is that people rationally trade their data for some goods, for some rewards. What we're arguing in some research that I've done, and I think we make a very good case for this, that it's really not a trade-off. We've tried to show, we do show in studies, that what Americans are is not so much interested in trading things logically, but they're resigned. 58% of Americans agree with the following two statements that we didn't put next to one another. We had them among a lot of different statements. One is, I'd like to control the data that companies know about me online. And the other is, I've come to believe that I have no way to control the data companies have about me online. Again, these were not next to one another. 58% agreed or agreed strongly with both of those. And we're arguing that when people give up data, it's not so much that it looks as if they're trading off information, but what's really going on, and I know this anecdotally from people, they just say, I can't do anything but that. I go on Facebook, not because I want to, but all my friends are there. How else can I shop if I don't use a frequent shopper card? And so we're in a situation, I wonder if people in Australia think this is true as well, where you feel in a bind. You're in this new world. You barely understand it, but you know you have to use it. And there's nothing you can do about it. Now, in some places, like in Europe, they're trying very hard to institute rules that give people a greater privacy. That's very difficult. And I don't know that they've gotten to the point in the retailing business where that's the case. They're trying to institute new laws, but the marketers are going crazy and pushing back. So we'll have to
Joe,
see what
very often one sees on the screen the soothing words that a given company has a privacy policy. Are we right to feel secure?
If your readers, first of all, I would bet that almost no one listening to this broadcast has read a privacy policy through. They're impossible to read. I've talked to people who write them, and they say that they're not written for normal people. They're written for lawyers. They're contracts. And if you read them, however, in most cases, you will find that retailers have the right to follow you around the store, to buy information about you in other places, to even look at what you say online and integrate that to information that they have about you. It's pretty amazing stuff. But as I say, almost no one really finds out about it.
Tell us about privacy policies and the Democratic National Committee.
Well, back in the day when Obama was running, I think you're referring to this, they actually did things that have even gone beyond this in the most recent election. But they would, for example, if I liked Obama on the in Obama's Facebook site, they would send all of my friends an ad with my picture saying Joe Turow likes Obama. Okay, and I had in that time no way to stop that. That was just done. The notion that people's profiles can be used in ways they have no clue about, and even the profiles people have no clue about, is something that I think we have to resist. Part of the reason I wrote the book.
I'm going to implement a new policy for the program. We're going to have a privacy policy, and people who come on to have a chat will just sit opposite me in the studio, and I won't ask them a single question.
That would be very quiet.
Yes, it would.
Your listeners would be lulled. I don't know if they'd appreciate it, but it would be quiet.
It would give them time to have their own thoughts, too. Which
yes.
They might be grateful about that. So let's sort of move towards the end of this with a brief chat about the hidden curriculum of the retail business.
Yes, well, the overarching argument I'm making in the book is, I mean, your listeners might say to themselves, who cares? It's just marketing. And there are a couple of things about that. It's a really good question, by the way. I'm glad you asked. The one reason that you should care is this is your life. Do we really want companies doing this to us without our permission? Is there a sense of indignity about that? That's one part of it. The other is, in fact, there may be prejudicial discrimination going on. I may be getting Tiffany ads or Tiffany discounts, and you may be getting some junky jeweler because they don't care as much as you. Tiffany doesn't care as much. The third thing, and this is where the hidden curriculum comes in, while everyone is worried about the security agencies tracking people, everyone's worried about online advertisers tracking people, on a daily basis, everybody is getting to learn the notion that in order to get along in the 21st century, we have to give up our data. That's the hidden curriculum. By using frequent shopper cards, by using your apps, by doing all this stuff, you and your kids are learning that this is the way it is. And maybe in 15, 20 years, people won't even remember that there was another way.
Joe, is it too late? Is there anything we can do, legislate?
I don't think it's too late, but I think we have to get angry. What I have started to say is we have to move from feeling creepy to feeling crappy. Creepy being, a lot of people say, gee, this is creepy. To me, what that means is I don't like it, but I sort of don't understand it. Crappy means I'm angry, and I'm going to start standing up to it. We have to shame companies that do stuff. We journalists have to talk more about this. People have to learn about it in school. And maybe governments have to stand up to the plate too, though that's a harder deal. And maybe if we shame companies and maybe if we make this clear what's really going on behind the screen, things will change. But we're living in a world of hyper-competition. And hyper-competition leads companies to do really weird things sometimes.
Joe, when I was a child, my favorite breakfast cereal was Kellogg's Rice Bubbles. And as you probably know, they used to murmur to you. They'd say snap, crackle, and pop. They spoke differently in different countries. I believe in Germany they said knisper, knasper, knasper. But here it was snap, crackle, and pop.
Yeah, US too.
It has been brought to my attention that the Rice Bubbles are now listening to us. And we've been listening to Joseph Turow, Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Joe's book, The Aisles Have Eyes, How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power, and Put Little Transmitters in Your Rice Bubbles. It's published by Princeton. Joe, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Take care.